From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. It's Book Week on Fresh Air, featuring the authors of all sorts of books. Today, the stories of the Horned Woman, the Windback Man, the Giant Colon, and the original Siamese twins. We hear from Gretchen Warden, the author of a book about the Mutter Museum, which she directs. Its exhibitions document deformed and disfigured bodies and the impact of destructive diseases. Also, we talk to the great sleight-of-hand artist Ricky Jay about his latest book, Dice, Deception, Fate, and Rotten Luck. It's a history of dice featuring photographs of his collection of decaying dice. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a reissue of the Thelonious Monk CD, Crisscross. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. U.S. officials say that six-party talks in Beijing aimed at resolving the nuclear impasse on the Korean Peninsula are the beginning of a process. State Department spokesman Philip Reeker says a second day of talks will be held tomorrow involving the U.S., Russia, China, Japan, and both North and South Korea. NPR's Vicky O'Hara reports.
The United States is trying to convince North Korea to forgo its nuclear weapons programs, as it promised in a 1994 agreement. Reeker says that during the first day of talks, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State James Kelly conversed informally with the North Korean representative, Vice Foreign Minister Kim Jong-il, for 35 or 40 minutes. But Reeker says there are no plans for a formal one-on-one talk.
There will not be any separate formal bilateral meetings with the North Koreans.
The meeting in Beijing was arranged only after North Korea gave up its insistence on bilateral negotiations with Washington over the nuclear issue. The U.S. insisted on a multilateral format, saying nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula threaten everyone. Vicky O'Hara, NPR News, Washington.
Britain's defense minister denies helping to write a government intelligence report released last September that claimed Iraq could mobilize a chemical or biological weapons attack within 45 minutes. Jeff Hoon testified in front of a judicial inquiry investigating the matter. NPR's Guy Raz reports from London.
Hoon told the court that he had no input in the government dossier that outlined Iraq's alleged weapons capability. Prime Minister Tony Blair cited the dossier when he made his case for war earlier this year. A BBC report broadcast in May cited the comments of a government weapons inspector who claimed Blair's dossier was exaggerated. That weapons inspector, Dr. David Kelly, committed suicide in July. Dr. Kelly's identity would have been kept secret, but the Ministry of Defense leaked his name to the media. Kelly is believed to have taken his life under the strain of the media glare. Defense Minister Jeff Hoon is accused of having made the decision to leak Dr. Kelly's name. Guy Raz, NPR News, London.
Police in Chicago say a fired worker killed six people at a Chicago auto parts warehouse today, then was killed by police when he refused to surrender. Phil Klein, Chicago's acting police superintendent, identified the gunman as 36-year-old Salvador Tapia. He said Tapia had a lengthy criminal record and should never have had access to a gun.
The problem here is easy access to a firearm. I mean, here's someone that should have never had a gun that had a gun, and it's tragic results from it.
Klein said Tapia had been fired about 6 months ago for missing work and causing trouble on the job. In stocks today, the Dow lost 6 points to close at 9,333 in light trading of just over 1 billion shares. This is NPR News. The New York Stock Exchange has agreed to pay its chairman, Richard Grasso, the sum of $140 million in savings, benefits, and incentives. The exchange also said it will extend Grasso's contract for 2 more years until 2007. The announcement has raised some eyebrows. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
To understand how much money the NYSE has agreed to pay Richard Grasso, chairman of the stock exchange, consider this. The $140 million in benefits and past incentives is roughly 4 times what the entire exchange earned in 2002. Several corporate compensation experts were critical of the payout, one calling it ludicrous. The 57-year-old Grasso, in a statement, however, said he needed to withdraw his deferred compensation and benefits in order to facilitate estate planning and will pay taxes on the money. In addition to the benefits, the deal would also call for Grasso to be paid a base salary of $1.4 million a year and an annual bonus of at least $1 million. Grasso has been with the NYSE for 36 years, serving as chairman since 1995. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
State workers have moved a controversial Ten Commandments monument from the rotunda of the Alabama Judicial Building. Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore, who installed the monument, called it a sad day and said he'll continue his fight to return it to a public place in the state building. Moore's eight associates on the state Supreme Court ordered the monument moved. Moore said his monument acknowledges God as the basis for American law. The federal courts have said it violates the constitutional separation of church and state. In stocks today, the Nasdaq gained 11 points to close at 1,782. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting 13, starring Holly Hunter and Evan Rachel Wood, co-written by a 13-year-old based on her own experience, now playing select theaters.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Book Week on Fresh Air, featuring interviews with the authors of all sorts of books. Gretchen Warden is the author of an illustrated book about the Motor Museum, a medical museum whose exhibits are of tumors, lesions, spinal malformations, Siamese twins, and other deformities, pathologies, and medical anomalies. The museum, which is part of the College of Physicians of Philadelphia, was founded in 1858 when students were taught about pathologies and deformities through preserved specimens, wax models, and plaster casts. Their Motor Museum is open to the public. Warden has worked there since 1975 and has directed it since 1988. Her book includes many photos of the museum's exhibitions taken by artists who Warden says are not interested in conventional beauty but want to explore its opposite, the deformed, the broken, the disfigured bodies of those who suffered congenital abnormality, trauma, or destructive disease. She adds, "While these bodies may be ugly, there is a terrifying beauty in the spirits of those forced to endure these afflictions." I spoke with Warden last November when her book was published. I want to talk about some of the specimens that are in the Motor Museum. And let's start with a plaster cast of a French woman's head with a horn growing out of the forehead. Who is this person and what's happened to her head?
Actually, it's a wax model. The woman, as far as we know, was known as Madame Dimanche, which has been translated as the Widow Sunday. And she was an 80-year-old washerwoman living in Paris. And she'd actually had some previous growths of this type. It's called cornucutaneum. It's a horny substance in the skin that starts overgrowing and producing these excrescences. And in this case, it happened to be a spectacular growth coming out of her forehead. And the model that we have shows it about 6 inches long. The reports, there's a published report in an 1851 journal that describes it as being, by that time, 9 or 10 inches long. And she had to support it in a sack sewn onto her nightcap until she finally got to the doctor and had it taken off.
How do you live with a horn growing out of your forehead for so long?
Well, I keep telling people, even today, people put off going to the doctor. And I think we all have a little reluctance. Back then, there was less that a doctor could do for you, so the hesitation was natural. That's one of the biggest questions. People look at her and wonder, how can you let it grow so long? And I point out that she was a washerwoman, and this is someone who takes in laundry. She probably was not dealing with the public. She was a widow, didn't have a husband around to nag her about getting that thing off your forehead. So I'm just speculating, but that's what she did.
Now, is this a problem that still exists? I mean, are people still growing horns out of their foreheads?
Absolutely. Anybody can develop this, and it can be found in animals as well, cats and dogs. But as I say, it doesn't usually get that large.
Now, there's a plaster cast of Chang and Eng, the original Siamese twins.
Right.
How did the Motor Museum get a plaster cast of the Siamese twins?
We had it made. And we had it made because we had just completed the autopsy on the Siamese twins in 1874. And that really was a great moment in the history of the college. These were internationally known men. And the question had always persisted from the first time they started going on public exhibit in 1829, could they have been safely separated? And they would challenge the medical profession with that question. And it was a way of getting publicity. And finally, when the College of Physicians heard that they died, they realized this was an opportunity to answer that question. And they actually were able to get the families to agree to have the bodies brought to Philadelphia, and the autopsy was done in the Mutter Museum at its original location at 13th and Locust Streets. And after it was completed, that was when we had the cast made. We were allowed to keep their actual livers as well, because those were the only organs that were connected through that band.
So are their livers still on exhibit?
Absolutely, right below the cast.
And how are they preserved?
They're preserved right now in a 75% alcohol solution.
Huh. So Chang and Eng were joined by the abdomen.
It was actually at the end of the breastbone, there's a cartilage, and they were connected by that cartilage. So the band mostly consisted of skin and cartilage with superficial circulatory connections going along the very thin strip of liver tissue that actually passed through that band.
How did they die, and what did the Mutter Museum autopsy discover about whether they could have lived independent of each other?
They died because a few years before, 1874, Chang had suffered a stroke, and he was not in as good health as Eng, who was the larger, taller twin. And so it came to one night in January of 1874 when he was having trouble breathing and was obviously ill. But they had this routine. They had married sisters in North Carolina and had families of 21 children, but they set up separate households in adjacent farms, and every 3 days, like clockwork, they would travel from one man's farm to the other so that each man could be with his family, be the master of his estate, and then they would go. So it was a dark and stormy night, and they probably should not have gone because Chang was not well, but he insisted that they go to Ang's house. And during the night, he died. And Eng woke up and found that his brother was dead and roused the household, and they sent for the doctor, who had always said, if one dies, I will cut close to the body of the dead twin and the other one should be able to survive. The doctor didn't come in time. And over the space of a few hours, Eng lapsed into a coma and died.
So did the autopsy find that they perhaps could have survived had they been separated earlier?
There is always that speculation that had it been done when they were children, when you have greater recuperative powers, it might have been successful. But they also discovered that in that band, unsuspected,
the band of muscle that joined them?
The band of skin and cartilage, mm-hmm. Yeah. There were slight outpouchings from each man's peritoneal cavity that contains their abdominal organs. So the band would have had to be very carefully dissected, because if you get into the peritoneum, then you can get massive abdominal infection. So the risk of infection was always there. And, of course, you're talking 1874. We're just beginning to use antiseptic surgical procedures. It's 20 years before x-rays. So you really couldn't get an idea ahead of time what you'd find. It would have been just operating blind, so to speak. So the conclusion was that in the best of cases, they might have been surgically separated, but it probably would not have been advisable at any point because of the risk of shock and infection, and certainly more so when they were adult men.
One of the things on exhibit at the Mutter Museum is a giant colon, a colon that grew to approximately 5 times the size of an average colon. What is the story behind this colon?
It belonged to a man who died in 1892 at age 29. And it's a congenital condition where you have a problem with the nerve supply to the muscular wall of the colon, so feces don't pass through normally. And you get backup of feces, and that's what caused the enlargement of the colon. Today we'd probably solve it by a colostomy or resection of the bowel, and they'd pick it up soon after, but we're talking the late 19th century. So it just got progressively larger as he grew, because at first he was able to function. He had various jobs as a messenger. And at one time he was actually on display at the famous dime museum at 9th and Arch Street as the windbag or balloon man. But as he got older, he was getting increasingly uncomfortable. So in 1892, we went to Hahnemann Medical College and complained to the doctors, and they correctly diagnosed it as an enlarged colon, but 1892, you weren't doing abdominal surgery that could have helped him in any way. So they took photographs, which we have on display at the museum with the colon, and then had to just send him away, and he died a few months later.
What did he look like?
He looked like a perfectly ordinary guy, about 5'7", a spare body, but with this enormously distended abdomen. And when they did the autopsy, they found that his abdominal organs were practically, you know, pushed up into his chest, up to his clavicle. So it must have been horribly uncomfortable.
So this colon is now preserved in what?
It was cleaned out, dried, and stuffed with a lot of Excelsior, which is just wood shavings. We found old newspapers in it. I mean, it was a big thing to stuff. So they put in a lot of material. And it's important now because it's a spectacular example. Megacolons are fairly rare, and they just rarely get to that size. So it is still impressive, even from gastroenterologists today. And it makes it very clear how far medicine has progressed since 1892.
You say in the book that one of the most popular exhibits in the museum is a collection of more than 2,000 objects removed from the throats and airways of patients, such as? What are some of the things that have been removed from patients' throats?
Well, the collection came to us in 1924. So there's stuff in there that you're not going to see around today. Collar buttons, for example, very popular with kids. We also have a lot of hairpins and safety pins. And I speculate that, you know, maybe it was a mother holding the pin as she's diapering the baby. Today you'd have diaper tabs. That's a current choking hazard. You also get a lot of toys you don't see. Jacks. I don't know if kids play with jacks anymore, but they certainly aren't using skate keys. And those are some of the items. Plus, there's a lot of dental appliances. I think dentists are more careful now about removing loose prosthetics from the mouth before they go in. But there's a lot of that slipped down people's throats.
There's a really eerie image in there. I think it must be like an X-ray or something, of a throat with a little toy battleship stuck in it.
Yeah, it's an X-ray of a child, and we have the little metal battleship, and it was successfully removed. Dr. Chevalier Jackson was the physician who assembled the collection, and it was to be used as a teaching collection because for each item, he has the complete case history, how old the patient was, where the object was, what it was, how long it had been in there, and what instrument was used to successfully remove it.
My guest is Gretchen Warden, director of the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Gretchen Warden is my guest, and she directs the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia. It's a museum of the College of Physicians of Philadelphia, and it was created in the 19th century as a museum of medical anomalies to teach medical students about the practice of medicine. And right now it's open to the public, and it's just a very, very popular place to see all kinds of medical mysteries. The Mutter Museum has a whole collection of fetuses stored in jars. What are some of the medical reasons for this collection?
Well, it's interesting. We just have redone that exhibit. It's called our teratology collection, and it's congenital abnormalities or birth defects. And it's important in the study of embryology and in the study of how the body develops normally. Oftentimes, it's only when something goes wrong that you're aware of how it should go right and at what point in the development. So It's a document of all the different things that can affect the development of the child. And it can be the internal environment. It can be things that the mother has ingested or is exposed to. It can be genetic. It can simply be a mutation in a gene. It can be caused by any number of environmental teratogens. And I think there are more of those today that can cause deformities. So it really gives us insight into the way human beings develop when you look at the anomalies.
And are most of these fetuses, were they mostly delivered or taken surgically from the mother's womb?
The older specimens would probably be either natural miscarriages or have been delivered normally. The more recent ones that we have with the severe anomalies are sometimes from pregnancies that have been terminated deliberately because the defect has been picked up on ultrasound or amniocentesis, and the decision was made not to carry the pregnancy further.
Is this one of the exhibits that gets, like, the most emotional reaction from people? Or I'm wondering if it's even controversial among some people.
It really, surprisingly, hasn't engendered any controversy because we have it within the context of the Hohlmutter Museum. We're an educational museum about medicine and human development. It's in a section where it segues smoothly into normal fetal development, conjoined twins. So because of that, people look at it as part of the whole display, which is why I don't sometimes like to have photographs of the fetuses taken and set apart from the rest of the environment. But people, of course, they're amazed sometimes to see some of these defects, and then they start reading the labels. Mm-hmm. And it's the same with all of the museum. Now, I get sometimes people react more strongly to the megacolon or to the swallowed objects. You never know what someone's going to identify with. They either have had a similar problem or they know someone with it. Some people can't get over that human horn.
Right. You know, one of the things that knocks me out, there's a couple of photographs that you've included in your Mutter Museum book of two women with lordosis, which is a severe curvature of the spine. And, you know, like the trunk of their body is about 3 inches in front of the rear of their body. And the waist is just kind of flat, like flat and extended.
Yeah.
So, like, the behind is on one end of the waist, and then several inches in front of it is the torso. It's like there's a flat thing connecting them. I'm not sure if I'm describing this very clearly.
Yeah.
But it's the kind of thing where you look at it and you could say, that's how I feel some days. You know? Well,
that's the way I feel about the megacolon.
Right.
Yeah. I'm feeling bloaty.
Is that a typical reaction that people that personally relate to some of these anomalies? Because even though these anomalies are just very extreme disfigurements, that you kind of feel that way on a smaller level sometimes.
Oh, absolutely. As I say, it's you are struck by the fact that you're looking at human beings. And there, but for the grace of God, go I, you say oftentimes. And thank God for modern medicine.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's, and of course, the fact is a lot of what we look at in the museum and think, oh, my God, nobody has that today. All you have to do is go into a third world country or go into rural America and you will find these, you know, incredibly disfiguring disorders. We are so spoiled by the fact that we're living in a city that has been a center of medicine since the 18th century, and we've got the best here. But that's not the way the rest of the world lives.
What's one of the exhibits that we haven't yet mentioned that gets a very strong response from viewers?
I think that would be the Wall of Skulls. It's a collection of 139 skulls from the peoples of Eastern and Central Europe that we bought from a Viennese anatomist in 1874. And this type of collection was typical of 19th century medical museums. They would collect skulls of people from all over the world, and thousands of them, and have them on display, because the whole idea is compare and contrast, be able to look at all of the differences between the skulls, which you can only see when you see a large number together. And what's fascinating is that Professor Hurdle, from whom we bought it, was able to record in most cases the name, the age, the occupation, in some cases a religion, and the cause of death of each of these individuals. So you're not just looking at a skull for the shape, as an anthropologist would. You're looking in a life, and you're seeing just a little glimpse of what people were living like in mid-19th century Europe. There's a mother who killed her child. There's a rope walker who died of a broken neck. It's wonderful from a sociological and cultural point of view. So you have this wall of skulls with this very cursory information, and you can look at it and just kind of imagine, if they had to summarize my life in four lines and write it on the side of my skull, what would they write? And we get that kind of reaction from people, too.
There's so many different ways to relate to the Motor Museum. One way is that, you know, it's fascinating medical history. It's a good teaching tool for doctors. Another is that it's just a kind of oddly beautiful representation of the human condition, all the things that could go astray with the physical part of the human condition. But another way of looking at it is it's just good, gross-out fun, right? And I'm sure a lot of people come to the Motor Museum for that reason, that it's good, gross-out kind of fun. How do you react when people come to the museum for that reason, to point and to laugh and giggle? And
well, I'll tell you, they may be drawn there out of curiosity.
Uh-huh.
Curiosity is a wonderful motivator. And possibly the curiosity is a little morbid. But once they walk into that space, they see the beautiful wooden cabinets and the rich colors of the carpet and the lighting, and then they start reading the labels and they're immediately sucked into the whole life of that individual and how it reflects back on your life. So you don't get a lot of poking and laughing. You'll get some comments like, hey, come over here, look at this. You won't believe it. But that's great. I mean, because it's wonderful to hear the interactions of people between themselves looking at these things and just quietly interacting with the specimen itself.
Well, Gretchen Worden, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Gretchen Worden directs the Mutter Museum in Philadelphia. I spoke with her last November after the publication of her book about the museum. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of The Stones of Summer, the novel that inspired the film Stone Reader. Available October 22nd at Barnes & Noble stores and online at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of A Place of Hiding, a novel of mystery set on the island of Guernsey by Elizabeth George, author of the Inspector Lindley Mysteries. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The great sleight-of-hand artist Ricky Jay is also a scholar of magic, con games, and sideshows. Coming up, he talks with us about his latest book, Dice, Deception, Fate, and Rotten Luck, as our book week continues. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new reissue of the Thelonious Monk album Crisscross. Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our book week continues with Ricky Jay, a master sleight-of-hand artist and a spellbinding performer. His one-man shows, Ricky Jay on the Stem, and Ricky Jay and his 52 assistants, were directed by David Mamet. Jay has acted in the Mamet films House of Games, Things Change, The Spanish Prisoner, State in Maine, and Heist. He's now working as a consultant to the Mamet film Sleight of Hand, which is about a 19th century magician who was America's most wanted serial killer. Ricky Jay is also a scholar of magic, con games, and sideshows. He's the author of two histories of unusual entertainments, Learned Pigs and Fireproof Women, and Jay's Journal of Anomalies. His latest book, Dice, Deception, Fate, and Rotten Luck, is a series of reflections and historical anecdotes about dice. The book also features photographs of dice from Jay's personal collection. These don't look like ordinary dice. They are old celluloid dice, and they are decomposing.
Ricky Jay, welcome back to Fresh Air. I want you to describe what the decaying dice look like.
Boy, it's actually difficult to describe, but over a period of years and years, dice which are made from celluloid nitrate in this case, which was the industry standard probably up till about the middle of the last century, eventually begin to break down. And they break down in the most amazing ways. I mean, they start, you see crystallization on the corners of the dice, and they move to the edges, and eventually fissures occur and stress and imploding of dice, where you can wind up with actual crumbling pieces, with the paint used to mark the pips on the dice moving, with the dice taking absolutely extraordinary shape, where the colors change, where material which might have been in the dice, both in the makeup of the celluloid, which would be cotton fibers and camphor in addition to sulfuric and nitric acid, but also if the dice were, adapted for use by cheaters. So if there were things within the dice, you may see them coming out. You may see oxidation. And this series of photographs which Rosamond took were absolutely stunning. I mean, just stunning.
I want to add that on some of these decaying dice, you actually see mold growing, and there is something so creepy about it. And I think part of what makes these photos so exciting to me is that they're inert substances that are dying as if they were organisms. And it's almost like a definition of surrealism. You know that surrealistic image of the cup that is fur-lined?
Oh, yeah.
This is what these dice remind me of, this like almost unholy combination of inertness and life. How did you start collecting dice?
Well, I suppose one could call them tools of my trade. I mean, as a sleight-of-hand artist, both magic and gambling techniques often involve dice, and so they're wonderful objects. And over the years, I realized, without consciously trying to amass an enormous collection of them, that I did have thousands of pairs of dice coming from disparate sources, from gamblers who reformed and took to other fields for their financial support, from collectors, from friends who would give me dice. And eventually I had many of them. And over the course of years, this breakdown of the dice, this decay and exposure, managed to make them create these unusual, incredibly unusual objects.
When you started collecting dice, did you have any idea that they were going to decay, or did they just surprise you and start doing it?
No idea at all. It was a complete surprise. I mean, I had seen dice in various states of decay. And, of course, older dice, really old dice, bone dice, ivory dice, don't decay in this way. This is, a man-made process. Celluloid is the first commercially successful manufactured plastic. So I suppose it should have a fate that suits that.
Now, these dice made out of celluloid, they disintegrate for the same reason that old celluloid film disintegrates, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, the photographer says that these dice smell also. Do they smell a lot?
They do. And I must say, keeping them in my house for a period of years, I would occasionally, at the request of my wife or various other visitors, have to move them into more secluded areas. I kept them largely in old plastic drawers and in a cupboard, and then you would not notice this rather odoriferous eminence. But if you took them out of the drawers, you certainly would.
How have you used dice over the years?
Well, just as objects to conjure with, I suppose, is the best way to express that. There are lovely effects that can be done with dice. Mysteries, effects of skill, and if one were choosing to talk about gambling or hustling, you could demonstrate, in fact, various things that could be done with dice.
You quote your grandfather who said that he was a magician, and he said he never played with cards because if he lost, he was thought to be an incompetent magician, and if he won, he was suspected to be a cheater. I was figuring that would probably be true with dice also.
Well, it is. I think I actually mention it in that aspect in the book because of the same thing, of people being suspected of being cheaters if they simply won. I mean, that bears to mind one of, I think, the most interesting anecdotes in the book. In 1544, we find the first serious account of cheating with dice in the English language. And of all places, it appears in a study on archery called Toxophilus by Roger Ascham. And in it, he talks about what I think is just a truly diabolical method of a cheater gaining his advantage. So he says in this particular game, a man that the cheaters want to take for their money is actually winning honestly. So what they do is to switch false dice into the game. Let the honest man throw the dice once and accuse him of cheating and then take his winnings. And that's in 1544. I mean, the level of duplicity is just wonderfully modern.
How are loaded dice made? Like, what's the principle there?
Well, the principle is that a foreign substance is placed into the dice at some specific spot to make it favor the throwing of certain points. So I think that's a reasonably accurate analysis of this, so that if it's heavier on one side, it'll make that side would tend to be thrown to the bottom so that the opposite side would surface. And various materials could have been used over the years, lead, gold, quicksilver, mercury. And then the placing of these loads within the dice became more and more sophisticated.
And what are the first forms of dice that you found in your research?
Well, I think it's pretty safe to say that dice come from astragali, which are the heel bones of hoofed quadrupeds. And this particular bone was quite attractive and six-sided and took well to decoration. And they say that the heel bone of the antelope was particularly handsome, and that was really prized by the throwers of astragali. And we think that only four sides were actually used in these dice games. And the evolution from astragal to dice is, at least to my knowledge, not based on any single event, that it takes place gradually over a period of years and years.
You actually reprint a quote from, it's a craps dealer, and his wrapper has come on. Do you have your book with you?
Yeah.
Could I ask you to turn to page 38? Maybe you know this by heart.
Yeah, I'd be happy to do this for you.
Thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, get your money down. It's betting time. The hard 6 and the hard 8 gets you 7-1. The hard 10, the hard 4 gets you 8-1. I repeat, get your money down. It's betting time, and we're off. Coming out for a point, bet the big 11. 7 is a crap. Bet the field. They come or they don't come. 5 and after 5, the field. They come or they don't come. Leave your money set and win a big bet. Don't cut it thin or you won't win. Leave it go and watch it grow. And the winner, 5 on the front line. And we're coming out for another point. Iolev, the winner.
What year is that from?
Boy, I would guess that's probably the litany of a craps dealer in the 50s or 60s. You know, just somebody doing their spiel trying to get someone to lay down money in a casino situation.
Are there many casinos where you have people who can do the spiel as well?
I think that becomes a dying art. It's very much like Carney, which we've talked about on past shows together, that the language of the Carney and the Carney come-on has changed enormously, that you used to have an outside talker, someone that would do the pitch, and that they would repeat this pitch over and over again. And the very concept of that has basically been replaced by a tape-recorded loop. And I think in large casinos, people think, certainly in the really classy casinos of Vegas, that a spiel like that is somehow an unfair inducement to bad betting. So I think in both cases they're dying out, sadly.
Why do you think the underworld and illicit activities have always had their own language?
Well, this becomes a very complex question, and one for someone whose skills are in areas other than mine. But I think the general thing that you hear is the idea that this language is used to be exclusionary. But I think people who study this carefully will tell you that's rarely the case. Perhaps the only thing that comes to mind as an absolutely exclusionary use of real language is the language of the pickpocket, where the pickpocket, the hook, the wire, the dip, the cannon, the man who actually takes the wallet, talks to his shill, his confederate, his stick, his stall, and literally gives him directions in actual conversation that would allow the stall to know where to set up and what pocket the dip wants to reach to take the wallet away. And the idea that that actually happens during the transmission of the crime is pretty wonderful to me. But it's the most specific example that I can think of.
So that they can talk in code and no one will understand.
Right. And then the concept of the office, which is giving a signal. It's a wonderful 18th century term that's still used by gamblers all the time. It's a method of communicating from one gambler to another. It could be silent. It could be through language. Now that I say that, it can be used in a Monte game with the operator telling the shill by language. The shill can't follow which is the actual card to be chosen, you know, where the queen is amongst the two black sixes. And so the operator, in the course of doing his spiel, will actually manage to tell the shill which card he should bet on.
Before you became a master of the con game and a historian of the con, were you ever taken? I mean, when you started to really love this stuff, before you knew how it worked, did you play three-card Monte and lose all the time? Did you play dice and with people who were cheating but you didn't quite know how, so you were losing?
Let me say that I have been in card games and games of chance in which people were moving. That's the correct term. People were absolutely moving. And sometimes you can determine it while it's happening, and other times you might have to go back after the game and recall, aha, that must have been what happened in this situation. I think anybody who thinks that they can't be cheated in a game is the perfect person for you to play against.
Why?
Because they're clearly suckers. Anybody can be cheated. I mean, they're just levels and new work that's being done all the time.
My guest is Ricky Jay. His latest book is called Dice: Deception, Fate, and Rotten Luck. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is master sleight-of-hand artist Ricky Jay. He's also an actor and a scholar of conjuring, con games, and sideshows. His latest book is called Dice: Deception, Fate, and Rotten Luck. Your Journal of Anomalies, which was like a very handsome, almost newsletter that you would occasionally publish featuring anomalies, freaks, and freaks from history, unusual performers, through history. You collected that a while ago into an actual book. Why are you so interested in people who would be known as freaks?
Well, I think I sometimes say that I'm not so interested in people who were just... For instance, Siamese twins don't particularly interest me, but Siamese twins who play the violin interest me enormously. It's a bit glib, but I think you see where I'm going.
Right,
that,
exactly.
That I really am interested in people who would overcome extraordinary difficulties and become, you know, just absolutely fascinating people. One man who actually crosses over to both books is a man we've talked about before, Matthew Buchinger, one of my true favorites, a man who was born in 1674 and was only 28 inches tall and had no arms or legs, and was an extraordinary magician, which is how I got interested in him. But he also played more than 8 musical instruments and danced the hornpipe and did trick bowling shots and fired pistols. And he also was a dicer. Matter of fact, I have this couplet about him in the book. He throws the dice as careless down as any gamester in the town. And though the number cast be 3, 2 sixes you shall ever see. So the idea of this 28-inch man who actually had no arms or legs, but he had two. Well, I guess the easiest way to describe his appendages were like the thalidomide flippers that we saw in this country some 20 or 30 years ago. But his enormous accomplishments are just absolutely intriguing to me. And he also, amazingly enough, was an extraordinary calligrapher. And I've managed over the years to build up a collection of original pieces of his calligraphy, often done on vellum, sometimes on paper in the early years of the 18th century. And because they were so good, they were saved, and I've been able to put together a rather remarkable holding of this. But I think he may be the man that I'm most interested in the world. I mean, it's just such an extraordinary level of accomplishment, and also in an age where these people were exhibited in horrible situations. Here was a man who was allowed to have a real education, you know, who had an interesting family life, who had many descendants who became accomplished in their own rights. I think his grandson was at one point considered the best lute player in England. Buchinger himself had 4 wives and 14 children. So he's just, to me, endlessly fascinating.
Where do you go to learn more about him?
Well, I don't know. I suppose every time that I'm on the road, this is one of the pleasures of my life. If I'm in a city performing, I manage to go to libraries and museums and bookstores and print shops in search of material. And in that way, I've been able to unearth a lot of material about him and various other people that I write about as well.
Do you think there's any contemporary equivalent of the freak show now?
Well, there still are some shows like this running. And you know, a man named Ward Hall, another man named Bobby Reynolds still put on shows like this that are great fun. And, you know, it's considered a dying entertainment on the level that there are far less of these shows than there once were. And politically, they're rather peculiar as well. But often, one has to talk to the person who's being exhibited, and often those people feel like they have an honest way to make a living and are not being exploited at all. But this is a difficult political issue. I mean, I love this world, the world of the carny.
Well, Ricky Jay, a real pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Terry, thanks very much indeed.
Ricky Jay's latest book is called Dice: Deception, Fate, and Rotten Luck. Our interview was recorded in December after the book was published. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a reissue of the Thelonious Monk album Crisscross. This is Fresh Air. In 1962, composer and pianist Thelonious Monk signed with Columbia Records after recording for little independent labels like Prestige and Riverside. Now he was with a corporate giant that had the clout to get him on the cover of Time magazine. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says Monk had finally become a modest commercial hit, and the way out iconoclast began looking like a wise elder. Never mind, he was still in his 40s.
Tea for Two from the CD Crisscross, one of four new albums in an ongoing Thelonious Monk reissue series from Columbia. All but one have been on domestic CD before. The exception is It's Monk's Time, though the new editions are spiffed up with extra tracks, including newly unveiled alternate takes. Crisscross from 1962 and 3 was Monk's second Columbia LP, and one of the best. The tune Crisscross is one of his most abstract and had fallen out of his repertoire since its 1951 recording. Bringing it back, Monk streamlined it, cutting two bars to hurry it along. Monk introduced few new tunes in the 60s. Mostly, he revisited his older masterworks and favorite standards, typically with a less urgent, if jauntier, feel than before. The new versions highlight his melodies, indelibly rendered by tenor saxophonist Charlie Rouse. Even some Monk experts flub the details of his tunes, but if you listen to Rouse, you'll know exactly how they go. The Monk classics here include Rhythmining, based on a lick that first turned up in a chart by his friend Mary Lou Williams. Andy Kirk recorded her Walkin' and Swingin' in 1936. Some Monkophiles deride Charlie Rouse as soloist because the saxophonist never really grappled with the composer's clotted harmonies, relying instead on bebop licks and scraps of the original tune. Fair enough, but his broad tone was a perfect foil for Monk's brittle piano, and he'd learned a lot from the master about timing and the use of space. Rouse put a distinctive stamp on this phase of Monk's career, despite a changing cast of drummers and bass players. That tuneful bassist is John Ory, who'd already recorded with eccentric pianists Elmo Hope and Sun Ra. On drums is Frankie Dunlop. Monk once revealed the secret of a good arrangement: make the drummer sound good. The composer left gaping holes in his elliptical themes, and Dunlop knew just how to fill them. This is Think of One. By the way, if you wonder why major labels reissue a lot of the same records over and over, It's because it's easy money repackaging back catalog as new releases. It gets vintage product back in the racks and maybe even reviewed again. It's a bit of a shell game, but it's hard to knock a scheme that keeps the classics in print.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Reader and the Chicago Sun-Times. He reviewed Crisscross by Thelonious Monk, which has just been reissued. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a duet featuring Lester Young and Nat Cole, recorded in 1946. Lester Young was born 94 years ago today.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, what to wear and how to speak. Book Week continues with the authors of advice books. Trini Woodall and Susanna Constantine are the hosts of the BBC series What Not to Wear. Patsy Rodenberg is a vocal coach who has trained many great actors. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.